This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest-running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoholoon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Toomer are the Hard Traveling Fanhounds.
Hard Traveling Fanboys! 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 Hard Traveling Fanboys!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Vancouver, British Columbia, to the Hoholoon Plaza, to the L-shaped studio. Welcome to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is my noise-making companion, Nick Duke. And we are here to present to you, for your listening pleasure, a very special edition of Countdown. This, of course, is our monthly series where we, well,
count down
lists of our favorite, least favorite, and various other assorted things related to the world of comics. Nick, how does this undisclosed night on Thanksgiving week see you?
It sees me well, I think. I'm doing all right. Left the office to go back to that godforsaken place until Tuesday, so that's good. And then, of course, once I left the office, I immediately got on my private hard traveling fan jet and made it all the way up here to Vancouver, Columbia, Canada. So everything's going well.
Everything's going great, man. I hope you can get back in time to fix Thanksgiving meal, because I know you got to get a lot of head start on that stuff for the fam.
I suppose. I suppose that's true, technically.
Yes, quite. Well, nonetheless, we are here tonight to bring you a special edition, as I mentioned, of Countdown, because we are counting down our pick for the top five creations of the late, great Stan Lee, who left this earthly plane just a week ago. And you know, we talked about here on the show, Nick, that this would be an approach for us to honor the legacy of the godfather of Marvel Comics, the sort of the public face of the comic book industry, and certainly the public face of the industry in our lifetime, Stan Lee.
Yeah, it was a great idea, and plus it coincided with a countdown that we weren't entirely sure we wanted to count down anyway. So it was just kind of fell into our laps here.
Serendipitous, if you will. And I'm not sure if I use that term properly, but we're just going to go with it.
Wasn't there a romantic kind called serendipity?
There was. I don't know who was in it or what it was about.
Yes, quite. Oh, my. Well, what an interesting set of circumstances that was. Hello?
Yes. Many, many things are happening here in the Hard Traveling Studio. Noises coming from various directions.
Somebody forgot to let Hoholoon out to use the bathroom, apparently.
Yeah, it's crazy what's going on here in the studio.
My lord, what just happened?
Nick, it's hard for you to hear it on your side of the studio, being shaped like an L and everything. But nonetheless, in the spirit of just going with it, rather than riff further on the movie Serendipity, which I know nothing about.
Serendipity was also the name of the Muse character in Dogma. By Muse, I don't mean Jason Muse. I mean a literal muse sent from heaven in the form of, oh, that actress, Greg. I've blanked on her name for a moment.
I remember singer.
Not Selma Hayek, but the other one.
That looks Selma like Blair?
No, she looks like
Selma Hayek. Penelope Cruz?
Maybe it was Selma Hayek. Maybe it actually, yeah, it was Selma Hayek, I think. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and then Alanis Morissette played God in the movie.
She did. Yes, that's true. We are on top of it tonight.
Why is it you can look at my face, but you shy away when I mention the name of God?
It was Selma Hayek who played Sarah Dippin in that movie. So there you are. What a great movie. Dogma.
It was, if only it were available streaming somewhere.
There are all kinds of issues related to the production of that film that are not interesting or relevant to the proceedings here tonight.
For once, we agree.
Mm-hmm.
So with all that being said, with all that rigmarole out of the way, why don't we get started on our lists, Nicholas?
Well, let's do that.
Why don't we get started with my choice for the number 5 greatest creation of the legendary Stan Lee?
Yes.
And my pick for number 5 is the Black Panther.
Interesting.
King of the Wakandan African nation.
I am interested to hear your rationale for this one, because as you described it to me on the phone, you were going to lean towards Stan Lee concepts that were created and kind of took off from the jump and were not that he developed upon by later writers, things that were
right,
that were near perfection from the get-go. So I'm interested to hear your
not
take on this.
Not necessarily. That's extrapolating a bit from where I was intending to go. I as I put this list together, I also realized that I wanted to, because full disclosure, Nick has much more experience reading early Marvel than I do. I've only read, I've read the early Spider-Man stories, a lot of them, and I've read some early X-Men and stuff like that. But what I also wanted to do was characters that meant a lot, characters that shifted the paradigm, Nick, in the comic book industry. And I feel like the Black Panther is one of those characters, not an African-American character, but an actual African character. And one of the, I'm not confident intellectual equal to the Avengers. So much so that he eventually joins the team on various missions. He helps out the Fantastic Four, also comes into contact with them. And you may have to correct me. Did he first appear in Fantastic Four or Avengers?
I believe it was Fantastic Four, and I should know that because we covered his initial appearance on Marvel Age not all that long ago. But I'm gonna say 95% sure he first appeared in the Ages of Fantastic Four. But I am searching to look that up for you. The problem now is when you type in Black Panther, you get everything about the movie. And not really much about the character. Yes, first appearance in July of 1966 in the pages of Fantastic Four, number 52.
Yes, and so as Black Panther is being created, Stan Lee, obviously all the creations we're going to talk about here are not just Stan Lee creations. In the case of Black Panther, it's a Stan Lee and Jack Kirby creation and their great, brilliant Fantastic Four run. But what Black Panther, the reason Black Panther makes my list over some of the other more popular or famous characters before the movie came out is what he represented to an entire group of people. The first time ever young black kids could see someone that looked like them in a comic book and standing alongside the Avengers and standing alongside the Fantastic Four and equaling them in combat. And then helping missions and being noble and powerful and fast and strong and wise and kingly. And while the Falcon would come along later and be a great African-American hero, I don't know that the Falcon was the difference maker because of some other characters that had popped up in DC and elsewhere that Black Panther was. And also even the name Black Panther, while this wasn't the intention of Stan and Jack when they named him that, the fact that it was a bold name that ended up representing a lot for a lot of people, that's the main reason that T'Challa makes my list, because I feel like if there was no Black Panther, it would have put progress back, and it also, it would have made a difference. We might be talking about, the Falcon might have been the first black Marvel superhero, if not for Black Panther, and I think that, when you take a look culturally at what's going on in the world around us, Nick, with the Black Panther character, the world would look a lot different if not for this creation. So that's why my list, even though it doesn't fit my list when we initially talked about I wanted characters that were kind of fully formed from the gate, a lot of what we know about Black Panther was introduced in many, many years later. I still think the fact that the character was introduced in the first place meant a lot to a lot of people, and for that reason, I feel comfortable putting him on my list at number five.
Well, there you are. Good reasoning. I considered Black Panther briefly, but I kind of looked at it from the standpoint of, you know, the Black Panther and kind of the mythology as we have come to know it would not really be defined for almost a couple more decades. So, undoubtedly an important creation. But for my number five spot, I went with a character who you could make a strong argument. In fact, I would say it, you know, you would be undeniably right to say that his initial run of stories were his best stories of all time, and he's never really hit the heights that he hit since then. So at number five, I'm going to go with Doctor Strange, a character that, if you've listened to any of our Marvel Age podcasts, dominates in terms of story quality the first several years, or not the first several years, but about 1903 to 1965 of Marvel Comics. A collaboration between Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. And really just this character, like so many other great Stan Lee creations, provided something to the comics reading community that wasn't out there. It filled a niche. It carved out its own special corner, not just in the Marvel Universe, but in comics in general, because this intersection of occult magic-based stories to redefine what people thought of when they thought of traditional comic book art, and especially traditional superhero art. The idea of exploring, you know, the various aspects of one's psyche in visual form is something that had never really been done before. All around, just an outstanding character with outstanding stories those first few years that Stan Lee and Steve Ditko unleashed onto the world. And it was a tour de force. And it's a character that has been a key figure in the Marvel Universe since. But I don't think anybody has ever really made the character sting and made and found that groove the way Stan and Steve did all those years ago. So for my selection, for really launching and creating the entire magical side of the Marvel Universe, I'm going Doctor Strange at number five.
Interesting selection, Nick. That I'm really interested in going back and reading the early Doctor Strange books because
it's outstanding.
Just what I've seen of Steve Ditko's art is mind blowing. So I've been interested in going back and reading that because Doctor Strange is a character we've discussed here on the show before that has never really grabbed me at all in the comics on the screen anywhere. And so I'm interested to go back and read those early appearances to see just how Stan imbued this character with life and energy that I felt like he's sometimes lacking in the stories in the 90s and the 2000s that I've read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I highly recommend those early Strange Tales. You cannot do much better than the first, like I said, about 3 years of Doctor Strange storytelling. And even once Steve Ditko departs from the character, you have some really good Marie Severin work. Basically, as long as Stan is writing the character in the pages of Strange Tales, I would highly recommend pretty much all of that. Once Stan leaves the character, it kind of, you know, loses its way a little. Very brief rationale for it is the X-Men as a concept perhaps embody the idea of the outsider and the outcast better than any other creation, not just in Marvel, but history of comics. And the X-Men have been used throughout the years to tell a variety of societally influenced stories, you know, ones that feel relevant and fresh and feel like they have something to say about the state of our world at various times. And as we've, another thing we've discussed on the Marvel Age podcast is this narrative that's out there that the X-Men didn't really become the X-Men until Giant Size X-Men number one in, oh, what was that, 72, I want to say, but I may be off on that.
74.
74, yeah, there you
something
go.
Like, so 72, something like that.
The point remains, that's the narrative, but really, if you go back and look at that early Stan Lee X-Men stuff, the X-Men as societal figures is kind of there from the beginning. You have the natural Martin Luther King to Professor X and Malcolm X to Magneto comparisons that can be easily there. And early X-Men comics are actually pretty good. I know they got canceled after a while and kind of were a dormant brand for a bit, but I would argue that didn't really have much to do with the quality of the story.
It was 75,
perhaps,
actually.
The comics reading community just 75, there you go. Perhaps the comics reading community just wasn't ready for that form of relevant storytelling, societally relevant storytelling, in the mid to early 60s, but the X-Men, as Stan Lee created them, that concept was strong jump. And with that, I will turn it over to you because you're a much bigger X fan than I am.
Yes, and with full disclosure, I've only read maybe two or three issues of the early X-Men comics. Maybe a little bit more than that, but not much. Most of my X-Men knowledge comes from the Chris Claremont, John Byrne, and so forth era of X-Men through the 70s and 80s when they redefined the mythos and led it into my X-Men of the early 90s. But it all goes back to that linchpin, that building block that Stan Lee laid alongside Jack Kirby in the early days of the X-Men, and setting up this, like you said, right, Nick, the socially relevant comic books of Marvel, like where Stan was always somebody that this stuff mattered to, that racism mattered to, absolutely hate in real life, or that they don't understand in real life. But what can happen is, I know a lot of people disagree with this. I believe in the power of metaphor, and I believe in the power of literature to slowly change hearts and minds over time. And not that I'm suggesting that X-Men actually did this, but I do think that X-Men planted a lot of young minds that it's not okay to hate people that are different, that it's not okay to pick on people that are different, that it is okay for you to be different. And this is stuff that I feel like was embedded in me by my culture that I absorbed when I was a kid. The X-Men was a huge part of that. And that goes back to Stan and what he wanted these characters to say and what he wanted these characters to do and to be, and to create villains that were identifiable to things that you see in real life, and they're fighting back against oppression, and they're doing it maybe not in the best way. So I think the X-Men, Nick, represents a lot of things to a lot of different people. And it just, the factness about a team of mutants that was created in the early 60s says a lot, I think, about the creativity that went into them, the creative energy that was going through Marvel at this time, and through Stan in particular, and also the lasting legacy of him as not just a writer, but as a human being.
Yeah, you said it perfect, Bubba. So, moving on to your number three.
Yes, I forgot that was both of our number four, yes.
Yes.
That's how countdowns work. So my number three...
that is the show we're doing.
...is a character that I have not actually read that many times in book appearances. Here and there, certain things. We encountered him in the Infinity Gauntlet, which we reviewed here on the show. We encountered him in different media throughout the years, including once memorably as a giant diarrhea cloud. The character that is number three for me is none other than the Devourer of Worlds, Galactus.
Interesting, interesting.
And let me tell you why.
Why, yes.
So here's why Galactus makes my list at number three. You know, he's a character that doesn't hold a special place in my heart. I'd never name him as one of my favorite characters in comics. Kind of an afterthought for me most of the time. But here's what he represented. He represented the culmination, in my opinion, of the outside-the-box thinking about superheroics that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby enjoyed. And particularly Stan Lee in this case, I think. Galactus is a character that is not motivated by the typical things that motivated comic book villains before Galactus was created. Typically, your villain's motivation would be wealth, power, jealousy, greed, gluttony, the seven deadly sins, any of them, basically.
What's in the box?
What's in the box? That would typically be your villain's motivations. You do Lex Luthor or Brainiac or the Joker or the Penguin or any of the Batman or Superman villains. You think back to even the Fantastic Four villains. I mean, their ultimate goal was jealousy or envy or something. And here along comes Galactus, whose only motivation, as it is just being. Years before Grant Morrison would would do his weird dark side is thing that Tom King has taken on to a new level. Pretty much that's what they were doing with Galactus without using that line. They were just basically just saying Galactus is. He's not bad. He's not good. He's just this demigod. He doesn't eat your planet because he doesn't like humans, because he hates human beings and thinks they're beneath him. He's eating the planet because he has to survive. It's just what he does. I think there's something incredibly fascinating about that. The idea of a true force of nature, when you explore that beyond a, you know, we've used the term to describe characters like Doomsday, but Doomsday is not just a force of nature, he's also a force of evil and destruction. Galactus is a force of nature in that he's literally, there's nothing you can do about him, unless you have the ultimate nullifier, I guess, but there's very little you can do about him. And he is not doing this malignantly. Let me rephrase
that. Maliciously.
Maliciously. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Not malignantly or benignly. But he is just doing this stuff, basically. And I'm just fascinated by that. And I think that I would introduce the idea that he opened the door to creators to think in a different way about how they created comic book villains. That it you could be as creative as you needed to be, or if you're Brian Knobs, you'd be as nasty as you want to be when you're creating these kinds of characters. And I think Galactus has been copied and duplicated many times in the comics, whether it be with the Anti-Monitor, whether it be with other force of nature characters that have come along. Giant characters, and that's, I'm trying to avoid talking about his look, but it's hard not to, about the great look that Jack Kirby designed for him. But just that idea that it's not really, it's an antagonist who's not really a bad guy per se. Fascinating, Nick.
Yeah, it's great. I did not even consider really Galactus for inclusion on this list. I briefly considered Doctor Doom, and I briefly considered Loki, you know, being villains that could be included here, but Galactus never really entered my mind. So interesting to hear that you went for him over one of the more well-regarded early creations. Not as well-regarded, but you get the idea.
Yeah. Even those two villains, I think you can still use those classic tropes of superhero comics, and Galactus is almost beyond that. Like he's a character that I don't know. Maybe he had a precedence before that, but I don't know of any character that far back that was presented that way. Mm-hmm. So that's why I made my list.
Awesome, good to hear. Well, at my for my number three spot, and this is gonna come as no surprise to anyone who knows me, I had to find a place for this character on my list, and so I am going with the mighty Thor at number three. No, Stan Lee did technically not create Thor, but he created the Marvel Universe version of Thor.
Thor was actually created by Sven Bergsagerson, the famous Swedish poet.
In the year 38, yes, that's true.
Yes.
But no, while he didn't create the concept of the God of Thunder, Thor, he did create the idea of the Marvel Universe version of Thor, a version of the Norse mythology that lives and breathes alongside the other characters who inhabit the Marvel Universe. Right away, distinguishing the Marvel Universe from other comics companies, distinguishing Thor as a character, because unlike so many others who, you know, were wearing suits of armor or had gotten their powers from a spider bite or a blast of cosmic rays or what have you, Thor was simply a god. And yes, early on you could, you know, you had the Donald Blake aspect with the magical cane and walking stick that was found in a cave and all that, but that was something that Stan was still writing the title by the time that Donald Blake started to be slowly de-emphasized. They realized what they had in the character of Thor himself. And really what Thor enabled Stan to do, much like Green Lantern would enable DC to do, is you're almost able to create an entirely new universe within your universe. The Thor mythology is so expansive, and you can do so many different things with it, whether it's exploring the Nine, which would later become 10 realms, or digging into the complex genealogy and family tree of the Norse gods, whether it's confronting the prophecy of Ragnarok, or whether it's just showing why and how a literal god who lived for eons and will live for eons still after the Earth is gone, comes to love and care about human beings and the planet Earth, and in its quietest moments and in its you know, worst moments as well. The character of Thor is just, it's so versatile. You're able to do so many different things with it. You can tell any type of superhero story. You can go, you know, epic and cosmic. You can go small and personal. You can tell a good old-fashioned, you know, Battle for New York kind of story that the Marvel Universe popularized so well in the 60s. And alongside Stan on this creation was, of course, one of his, arguably his greatest collaborator, that being Jack Kirby. And other than the Fantastic Four, and even possibly above that four, when you read these early Thor comics, you can see that there might not have been any character that Jack Kirby liked working on more than Thor. The love and passion that pours out from every single panel is just remarkable to look at. Action sequences that stun, and landscapes, whether they be on Asgard or other realms, are just breathtaking to behold. Thor was just a comic that, much like so many others, there wasn't anything else like it in Marvel or in comics in general at the time, and it just provided this whole other tableau that Stan and Jack could use to tell stories, and just became another major part of the Marvel Universe. So I've always been a massive Thor fan just because of, as I said, the verse of stories and how expansive the mythology is. And none of that would be possible without Stan and Jack fleshing that concept out in the early days of the Marvel Universe. So for me, the Mighty Thor at number three.
Excellent pick here, Nick. I think the Marvel version of Thor is also very influential. You think of how that using an existing mythological pantheon to build a superhero universe out of was used much later on by George Perez with Wonder Woman.
By Jack Kirby again, not an existing mythological pantheon, but Jack Kirby essentially creating his own mythology with the new gods,
yes,
at DC.
With the new gods
that
over
is
DC.
Very Thor influenced when you go and look
absolutely
at that.
Yes, very much so. And we see it even still to this day. Mm-hmm. So hugely influential, hugely important, and most importantly, hugely fun comics, mm-hmm, across the board. Well, for my number two, I am going to use my second of two cheats on my list. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I am with the Marvel Bullpen.
Oh my. Go ahead.
And here's my reasoning.
Okay.
So when I say the Marvel Bullpen, I really mean Marvel comics outside of the actual comics. Or rather, within the actual comics, but not in the fictitious world. The real life Marvel comics, or at least the characters that Stan created for him and Jack and Steve and Don Heck and all the rest of the people, Roy Thomas, that were working at Marvel back then. I'm including in this Stan's soapbox. I'm including this in this bullpen.
Oh, flow starter. You gotta throw flow in there.
Yes. I'm including bullpen bulletins in there. Mm-hmm. Because what this in some ways could be number one on my list. Because what really made Marvel different from what came before it? There had been, the Marvel method had been used before in comics. There had been street level realistic superheroes before in comics. There had been complex cosmic heroes in comics before this. There had been grittiness in comics before this. One of the things, there were a few things that made Marvel different, but one of the things that made Marvel different was that for the first time ever, people felt like they were part of a family with Marvel. And it wasn't just the characters that they were invested in. on the printed page. It wasn't, I can't see what Spider-Man does next month. It's, I can't wait to see how Stan writes Spider-Man next month. I don't know if that makes sense, Nick, but maybe a good way to describe it is the way that people watch wrestling now versus the way people watched wrestling 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
To a degree.
So instead of simply being invested in the characters and what they do, people became invested in the creators. There's this great audio clip on YouTube that I think I've shared in our private group of Stan speaking at a college. He went on a college speaking tour in the mid-60s, and he was at Princeton, and he announces at this speaking engagement that Steve Ditko has quit Marvel. And it's this huge reaction of boos because people are invested in this. Now, let me ask Nick what would have happened if the same panel had happened for the competition at the time and somebody said, you know, let's say 15 years earlier, and somebody said Bill Finger is leaving Batman. It would have gotten silence because nobody would have known who he was or what he represented. People didn't care about the creators in those days. Stan made them care about the people behind the comics as they cared about the characters on the page. And it created this familial atmosphere. Stan was that guiding voice in the back with Stan's soapbox, where, you know, we've seen it shared on social media since his death, his treatise against bigotry and against oppressing those that are different. And he had such a respect among the readership because of this character that he created for himself, that he parlayed in great success outside of comics, that it helped create a community, a true, you know, we bemoan the modern comics community a lot, Nick, on this show, but the bottom line is there would be no comics at all, I don't think, if not for what Stan and Jack did at Marvel to foster it, because they created this culture of fandom that really crosses the line into family, into feeling like you're invested in what happens with Marvel, that it's not just we're presenting you a product and you will react to it. It's we're all in this together. And if you don't like, then we've got to figure out why that is, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. You know, like it was a more direct connection with the audience than had ever been seen before in comics. And I would argue that has probably ever been seen since, because I don't even think that today it's never been your comic book creators to get in touch with the fans, but because of the nature of social media, it feels like it's turned into this combative thing rather than what it was back then, which was a sitting at a dinner table and talking shop before the direct comics market was really a thing. It was a place where you could feel like you belonged, like the sci-fi magazines of the era and things like that. And so I think in a lot of ways, it's like, it is almost like if something like that could exist for wrestling, you know, there really isn't, but it's a place where you crossed the line in that era of Marvel from being in kayfabe to going behind the curtain and seeing the performers behind the characters. And so I think that this was a huge step up. I think creating this cast of characters and stuff changed the medium forever because it became a creators-driven medium as opposed to a characters-driven medium for the most part. And, you know, you think back to Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill and Frank Miller and all these larger-than-life personalities that are creators that we know. And I wonder how and if we would have known them or become as familiar with them, if not what Stan established with the early Marvel that was later tried poorly replicated by others over the years.
Absolutely. Yeah, great pick. It's an unconventional pick, though. I like your attempt to innovate and bring something to the list that was unexpected. But I would argue that we wouldn't be sitting here talking about any of this if you don't go back to probably the most conventional pick that could possibly appear on one of our lists. And whether you have an appreciation for modern interpretations of the concept and the characters or not, the Marvel Universe, as we know, would not exist without going all the way back to November of 1961 and the creation of the Fantastic Four, who are the number two entry on my list.
Oh!
The concept of the superhero familial unit. Yes, you could argue there had been attempts to use that in other comics prior to this, most notably
Challengers of the Unknown.
Challengers of the Unknown, and I would argue the Marvel family over in the page of the Fawcett of that time that featured Captain Marvel,
yes.
Which, by the way, is his only true name. He should only ever be referred to as that, but I digress. But here you have a family that isn't just related to one another, but they have squabbles. They have issues. They have problems with one another. They fight. They bicker like an actual real-life family. And most importantly, over that decade of Marvel stories, they grow. The characters legitimately change over that decade. When we are first introduced to them, we have Reed and Sue, who are very clearly in some sort of romantic relationship alongside Reed's best friend, Ben Grimm. And
who's kind of an asshole, by
who
the way,
is
Ben Grimm.
Very much an asshole, especially in those early comics. That's one thing we discovered on Marvel Age is the ever blue-eyed thing that we all know today was not really a thing the first couple of years of Fantastic Four. He was very prickly. He was something of a misanthrope and a little difficult to like, but slowly, over time, he changed. And that was the beautiful thing about these characters. We got to watch them grow as a family over those first 10 years. We got to see Reed and Sue work through their feelings with one another, and eventually that culminated in a marriage. My God, can you believe it? An actual comic book marriage. Not just that, we got to see them start their own family. You know, Sue eventually became pregnant, and we got to see how that affected their superheroics and their responsibilities to the rest of the Marvel Universe. We got to see how Reed coped with that newfound responsibility of fatherhood. We got to see how, you know, Ben and Johnny responded to the challenges of being, you know, both a literal uncle in the case of Johnny and a figurative uncle in the case of Ben, and that newfound responsibility for them. You just got to see them grow in terms of their growing celebrity, dealing with being public figures in ways that they had never really been before. And all along the way, they're being challenged by interesting and compelling rogues early on. Dr. Doom, of course, being the most notable one. You have Galactioned earlier. And more so than any other title, Fantastic Four also is serving as kind of this incubator and this proving ground for new Marvel concepts, whether it's the Black Panther, like we talked about a little bit earlier, the Silver Surfer, Galactus, so many different characters, the Inhumans, which again, take him or leave him, but so many different characters who are making their first major appearances in the pages of Fantastic Four, because for so many years, it was the undisputed flagship title of the entire Marvel universe. And to me, it's because that book in its earliest years speaks to what ultimately set Marvel apart from its competition and what enabled it to build the foundation on which the Marvel Universe we've built and the ability. Yes, other comics had tried to be relatable at that point, but I don't think that anybody had ever really pulled it off to the degree that Stan Lee.
It's interesting because I think in the early episodes of Marvel Age, you were kind of almost saying because of the other books you were reading that you were having a hard time seeing the innovation in Fantastic Four in the earliest issues, and then I think it came to you later on, right?
As they began to grow. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, it's something that I'm interested to track on Marvel Age when we get there is I want to try and identify – I don't know, you know, if you'll be able to identify like the exact day or month or whatever. Identify the point where the Marvel Universe became locked perpetually in place because – for the first 10 years, we have seen just all the growth from Fantastic Four. We have seen Peter Parker graduate from high school, move through romantic partners, have relationships in his life come and go. Things are actually changing for him. He is being allowed to age. All of these characters are being changed. And I'm interested to see if we can identify a vague time frame as to when people started to recognize, oh man, these characters have staying power, so we can't keep letting them age because eventually they'll become too old, you know? So I'm interested to see when the
imagine
Marvel...
Imagine having to actually progress your universe and characters.
Yes, I understand, but I mean, again, that's what sets the first 10 years of Marvel apart, is that was happening.
Absolutely, it's brilliant.
Yes, so I'm interested to see when that stops or starts to slow down.
And it's, you know, it's kind of the way that's you would think serialized entertainment would work. You know, something like a soap opera doesn't really have any choice but to progress its characters and age because they, you know, real life people age, unfortunately. But so yeah, that's a excellent point that I wonder if it's as soon as he leaves, as soon as he stops writing regularly in 72. I don't know. I'd have to. It would be interesting to track.
Yep, we're going to work on that.
So that brings us to the perfunctory number one on our list, Nick. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty certain that we're both going to have the same painting here at number one. And my number one, of course, is going to be Peter Parker, the Amazing Spider-Man.
Of course. That of course, is my painting.
Yes, and Spider-Man's not my favorite Marvel character, probably not even in my top five favorite Marvel characters, but that being said, he's an amazing character.
Spectacular,
he's,
even.
He's spectacular.
He's friendly even, neighborhood.
He's even web of.
Web of, yes, that's my favorite.
And he's a great character, and he makes this list not because he's a great character, because there are lots of great characters that Stan created that didn't make our lists. You could go down the list, all the X-Men, you could go down the list of the Fantastic Four that didn't make my list. You go down Thor that didn't make my list. There's all kinds of amazing Silver Surfer didn't make either of our lists.
Who was Stan's favorite character, by the way. That was his favorite character that he ever created.
It sure was. And there are so many great characters. But Spider-Man doesn't make this list because he's a great character. Spider-Man makes this list, again, because of the impact that he had, because of how fully formed that he was from the get-go, and particularly in those early years. One of the things that you realize when you read early Spider-Man is just how many writers and artists have come along and done the exact same stories over and over again over the years in different forms. And that's because the early stories are really good.
Yes.
They are really, really good comic book stories. And the idea of Peter Parker being this, you know, nerdy, shy, awkward teenager who's pissed off a lot at the world, pissed off at his friends, pissed off at his circumstances, who just seems to have the worst luck in the world. But tries to do the right thing and is eternally punished for the mistakes that he does make. This was all innovative shit. This was all creative and outside the box stuff. And it was also, you talked about relatability with the Fantastic Four. Spider-Man, as the saying goes, is the most relatable of all superheroes. Because most people, not all, but most people, particularly in those days, most people that read comics have a lot in common with Peter Parker before he gets bitten by the radioactive spider. Maybe you had a rough, sort of a rough childhood. Maybe you are interested in things that other people consider to be outside the norm, that you're not considered cool. You're picked on. You're bullied. You don't have any luck with in the world of romance. You know, you have all of this stuff going against you. And here's a character in a comic book who's just like you, but he has these amazing powers, and you can live vicariously through him the way that Peter Parker, in some ways, lives vicariously through Spider-Man. It's such an incredible creation at a time when you would not have expected it. You would have expected a teenage character back in the early 60s to resemble closer to Snapper Carr or Jimmy Olsen or someone like that. Or
Rick
even a
Jones.
Rick Jones, or even a John Storm, than what Peter Parker is. Peter Parker isn't the idealized, gosh, I wish I was like him. Peter Parker is the, he is me, and that could be me if I had superpowers. And so it is this ultimate vicarious fantasy for the reader that inspired a generation and further generations of superhero creations in the 70s, 80s, 90s, on through today. People still draw on Spider-Man and the archetype created by Spider-Man when they're making new characters trying to relate to the youth of today. So I just can't say enough about how innovative Spider-Man was, his supporting cast, his rogues gallery, his world, his living, breathing New York City. For all the characters that inhabited New York City, none of them it felt like inhabited a real city as much to me as Spider-Man, where it's such an essential part of everything he does. And I think it's amazing what Ditko and Lee did in creating this world of Spider-Man. The villains, a character in Peter Parker who is so good that, again, like I said earlier, people have just been essentially retelling the first 10 years of Spider-Man stories ever since. And you pointed out, Nick, a character that was allowed to grow and develop in a way that we had never seen before, graduating high school, going through college, getting a job. It's something that I think people – I think there's still an audience for characters like that and for stories like that. And maybe outside of stuff like Invincible, you don't really get to see anymore in terms of super awesome stuff, amazing character, and I'm sure you've got even more to say about Peter Parker.
Man, I don't really know what else I can add to that. That was a well done bit there. I will say I alluded to the fact earlier that the Fantastic Four helped the Marvel Universe to build its foundations on relatability. And I would argue that as relatable as the Fantastic Four were, Spider-Man came along and built the house on top of the foundation. It took that concept of relatability to a whole new level because, as you said, who can't relate to Peter Parker? The guy who feels shunned and ostracized at times. The guy who feels justifiably angry at being shunned and ostracized. And here he is, given these amazing powers, and he has to deal with the temptation to use them for personal gain. And ultimately, he has to learn the lesson of, with great power comes great, there must also come great responsibility, and he has to pay a price for his own selfishness. He doesn't automatically use his powers for good just because it's the right thing to do, because very few of us would actually do that. You know, let's be honest. We aren't that good as human beings. We aren't that intrinsically noble. But we can all learn from life experiences, and we can become better than we were. And I think that is the magic of the character of Peter Parker, and especially that origin. As you said, his rogues gallery, his supporting cast, all of whom are allowed to grow and move forward over those first 10 years, there really is nothing like it in comics. Again, alluding to Marvel Age, that's been the biggest revelation, is a lot of things that you and I both have read from the era of comics, we will say, that's pretty good for a 60s book. But I'm here to tell you now, that those first 10 years of Spider-Man stories, man, those aren't just good for 60s books. Those would hold up and compare favorably to anything from the modern context. They're that well done, they're that relatable, and they are that engrossing once you get into that world and occupy the space within Peter Parker's head. So
you might even say they are the game, and they are that damn good.
That damn good. So there you are. I agree with you. Spider-Man is the undisputed greatest Stan Lee creation.
Well, HTF listener Ben Whitehead agrees with you, as he has tweeted us to say Spider-Man is the one only pick for him of Stan Lee creations. The allegories for other characters are great, but I love Peter Parker and all of his assorted adventures. We also heard, and he is at Ben on Sports, we also have heard from L_Chicklets, Omar A., and he says Stripperella is his favorite Stan Lee creation.
Well, there you are. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite frankly.
Yeah, decent.
If you guys out there have your lists ready, we want to hear them. Send them to us through Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. You can email your list to us, greg@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, or you can reach out to us on Facebook through the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook group. Just type in Place to Be Nation Comics, join, and discuss. So we want to hear your list, and just to remind you, Nick and I will run through our list one more time. Mm-hmm. At number 5, I had the Black Panther. At number 4, I had the X-Men. At number 3, I had Galactus. At number 2, I had the Marvel Bullpen. And at number 1, I have Spider-Man.
Yeah, at number five, I had Doctor Strange. At number four, I had the X-Men. At number three, I had the Mighty Thor. At number two, I had the Fantastic Four. And at number one, I had the Amazing Spider-Man.
Excellent stuff. Well, we're going to take a little commercial break-a-rooney right now. And when we come back on the other side, we will have Reading, Watching, and you bet your ass we'll have the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place for Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the PlaceForNation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTBN Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
For making,
better.
Things better.
Face facts, Nick.
Because your opinion doesn't matter. Quite frankly.
Well, that's a bit harsh, but nevertheless, the facts we're going to get to right now are related to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics, Nick. And it's a segment we like to call Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. And it's a segment this week, Nick, that isn't doing much to dispel rumors and innuendo about our biases.
I would agree. Yeah, it's a very DC rundown this week. But, you know, we do the best we can. We can only report the news as it is, not as we would like it to be, folks.
That's right. And we're not going to report on Hulk Vereens. Well, Nick, kicking us off in the world of comics is a story that I know caught your eye in particular recently, and that is that DC has announced their plan for March 2019's Detective Comics number one 80-year anniversary. So they did this a similar thing for Action Comics number one's anniversary this year. Next year, it will include two books, Detective Comics number 1000 and Detective Comics 80 Years of Batman, the deluxe edition. It says here that incoming Detective Comics creators Peter J. Tomasi and Doug Monkey are scheduled to write and draw number 1000's lead story, mm-hmm, with additional stories by Jeff Johns, oh, Brian Michael Bendis, oh, Paul Dini, oh, Christopher Priest, Amy O'Neill, oh, Neil Adams, Kelly Jones, Dustin Nguyen, Alex Maleev, and my favorite Batman writer of all, more.
Vince McMahon watching Stacy Keibler dance on the table gif.
The issue is scheduled to run 96 pages, which would put it on some graphic novels we've seen.
Listen, listen. As excited as you and Russell and so many others in our comics community were, and I was as well, to a lesser extent, as excited as you guys were about Action Comics 1000, because of your massive love of the character of Superman, I am just as, if not more so, excited about this. I mean, Detective Comics 1000, a celebration of all things Batman, and then you combine it with that list of characters. Like, I am going to go to the stands and buy a Batman book that is written at least in part by Pete Tomasi, Jeff Johns, Paul Denny, and Brian Michael Bendis. There is nothing more for me in this world than that. And the thing is, much like Action, I am expecting that we will get more creator reveals as we draw closer to this. There are some big ones still out there. I don't know if they will, but if they could get Greg Rucka to do something, that would be amazing. Of course, there's the unicorn idea of getting Brubaker to do something. So many different ideas, so many different possibilities for collaborations, but just...
And interesting that Frank Miller's not listed as of now.
That's true. But just this early list, I mean... Hard to imagine putting together a better who's who of comic book writers to tackle the Dark Knight. Detective Comics 1000. I am pumped for this. And I am even actually probably going to wind up buying that 80 years of Detective Comics companion book.
I was about to get to that. The companion Detective Comics 80 Years of Batman is hardcover overseen by former DC publisher and writer Paul Levitz that will include... several rare and unpublished comic shorts from Batman's history, including a Levitt and Dennis Cowan story and the original layouts from Detective Comics number 200 by Lou Sayer Schwartz. And it says Bob Kane, but Lou Sayer Schwartz was a ghost artist for Bob Kane, so it's probably just his original layouts. Mm-hmm. And it will include essays about Detective Comics and Batman by Cory Doctorow, Neil Gaiman, Glenn David Gold, Denny O'Neill, former San Diego Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman, and pulp historian Anthony Tolin.
This is awesome. Yeah, I'm all in for this. I mean, I can't freaking wait. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be great. What a list of creators. Of course, my boy Christopher Priest will be in there writing Batman, which is something he's always wanted to do on an extended basis. Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams reuniting. How great is that?
Yes.
Yeah, just so
and
much.
And if you have any questions about how great it is, just ask Neil Adams. He'll tell you all about it.
He'll tell you in no uncertain terms. But that's not the old Batman comics news that we've gotten this week, Nick.
Mm-mm.
We got a new update that I'm sure is extremely important to you.
Yes.
And to you.
And I know you're excited about this as well.
Oh, I've never been as excited about any comic book announcement we've covered on the show, I don't think.
Mm.
Certainly, this is in the running.
Mm-hmm.
So, Batman writer Tom King, he of the 100-issue-long-plus Batman run that is being plotted out as we speak, has stated that he is off of Batman in February for number 64 and 65.
Mm-hmm.
However, he says the reason that he is not writing them is due to an outside secret television project, but that he will be returning right back to the title in March 2019. Josh Williamson, I guess, is writing is writing Batman for that month.
It's a two-part Flash crossover story. Something of a sequel to Button, from what I understand. And I believe it's going to be like last time, it's going to be a four-part story that'll be two issues of Flash and two issues of Batman. And so Tom King had to write this television thing that he's not talking about yet, and it kind of just lined up that Josh Williamson could naturally step in, right tire, Batman flat over, and it just kind of naturally fell that way on the calendar.
And don't worry, folks, if you're worried that Tom King's epic run might be cut short, he made it clear. He said he's always said he's doing 103 Batman issues, because that's 100 of his own issues.
Mm-hmm.
Does this push the run back to 105? I think so. The story will still end at 100. This will just give me more issues, he says, for coda/emotional wrap-up stuff.
Mm-hmm. which will now occupy its entire own trade at the end. So that's
it can get its own trade just for the coda slash emotional epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
So what issue are we on right now on Batman, Nick?
That would be a great question for someone who's read an issue of Batman recently or read an issue of a comic book in general recently. Let's see. If February, you said, was what, 63 and 64?
I think.
So at two issues a month, do the math, that means we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 57, 58 probably right now.
So I only have to wait about 50 more issues.
Which is about 2 years, about a little over 2 years.
Before I can give Batman a chance again.
Mm.
All right. That's exciting news, Nick. I'm pumped. Now I have an end date in mind.
I am just happy that for once the shoe is on the other foot.
What do you mean?
Now the tables have turned, Darkness. You're always telling me how cynical I'm being and how I hate everything. And now here's something that everybody else loves, and you're just – here you are crapping on it.
No, I don't have to – here's the thing, though. I was only doing that to play into my gimmick here of it. I'm not going to crap on other people for liking it. See, that's where we differ, you and I. Mm-hmm. Okay with people liking Tom King's Batman. I don't get it. I don't understand it. But I'm okay with it. Not like you and your Grant Morrison hatred.
Yeah, a hatred that you share, but you're just in the opposite opinion to play devil's advocate.
Oh, that's
not- I got to tell you something about that, by the way. So, you and I share one thing in common. Despite my claims of hating everyone and wanting to, like, just everybody to leave me alone, sometimes I'm for my own good, and I don't know how to say no to people. So, like, the other day, I'm standing in line at the comic shop, and the guy pulls out my pull list from behind the counter, and he hands it to me, and I'm looking at it, and I have 10 books, and I go, oh, no, there's 11 here. What's going on here? And I leaf through them. I'm like, oh, no, there's clearly been some sort of misunderstanding here. And I looked at the guy, and I thought about saying something, but, like, he's always posting about the financial troubles the shop is having on Facebook. And I was like, all right, do I tell him I don't want this $5 comic book, or do I just bite the bullet and clear up the misunderstanding next time? So, against my better judgment, I am in possession of a copy of The Green Lantern number 1 from Grant Morrison and Lee Sharp.
I knew you'd get it. I just knew.
I didn't want it. I honestly didn't. It, like, I felt like a bad person telling him I didn't want it, and so I just bought it.
Yep. Well, now you know how I feel every time I buy a Tom King Batman issue. And I'm like, well, I guess it was on my pull. I should buy it. Then I took it off my pull. But
well,
no,
this wasn't on my pull. There was some sort of misunderstanding because Green Lanterns is on my pull. And Green, you know, Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps was on my poll.
Right.
But I don't want this. I don't want this crap.
Well, we'll see.
I'm going to read it.
Now you have.
I'm going to read it, then I'm going to come on here and I'm going to shit on it. Like I already know I am, so we'll see.
Much like Klondike Bill, you're going to come on something and shit on it.
That's right.
that was a bit naughty even for me. anyway. I got nothing to get, you know, I'm sure people love it. It's great and all that. Maybe it'll read great in trade. And to your point that you said earlier, Nick, I could just buy the 4 or 5 deluxe Omnibuy collections when they come out and read it as one story, the way it's intended.
The way it's intended, yes. Yes, that is accurate. So I'm, you know, we will see. We have another couple of years of this to get through. It's going. Greg, why don't you just let it play out and see where it goes?
And see where it goes. Good point. I'll tell you what. I'll do that with Tom King's Batman if you do it with Grant Morrison's Lantern.
Larry David.
Hey, speaking of things that actually we are both misanthropic about, we've got our new Lex Luthor.
No, you tried to defend this. I don't want to hear it. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, sir. No.
I was coming into it with
an opinion. No, go ahead and tell the people what the story is, and then we'll get into this. But no, I will not take I'm being misanthropic about it. Bullshit. Bullshit.
Well, Supergirl has finally cast its Lex Luthor.
Uh-huh.
And it's somebody that actually has an on-screen Luthor appearance before, although Lex. You see, John Cryer, the former co-star of Two and a Half Men, the co-star of Pretty in Pink, also portrayed Lex Luthor's nephew, Lenny Luthor, in Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
Oh, my God.
Well, he is going to be playing Lex Luthor on Supergirl.
And Greg now, defended it. Greg defended it.
When well, they defended. You say defended. How did I defend it?
Here's my exact words. Here's what I said. I'm not going
to
read your exact words. I don't need to exactly quote you. Besides, you would just make up a quote anyway. Well, you're a fake news journalist, a former fake news journalist anyway, after all. But that's neither here nor there. When this news was announced, me being me, I hate most things. And my God, did I hate this. First of all, I don't even really like Pretty in Pink. So, you know, let that be what it is. I just 2.5 Men, and those are the only two things I've ever seen this jackass in. But even beyond that, it's a larger, seemingly conceptual issue. Now, yes, it's possible that they could have said, we want this ultra-serious, menacing version of Lex, and we're going to go out and get John Cryer to play it, because nobody will see it coming. Maybe that's what's happening. Maybe I should be giving them more benefit of the doubt than I am. But what it signifies to me is that they're going to go with the campy, over-the-top comedic version of Lex. As a result, it is already, regardless of who you cast, something that I am predisposed to hate. Then you add in the fact that I think John Cryer is generally a shitty actor and bad at his job, and I called it, and I stand by it, by the way. I called it a Chris Klein-level casting decision on the part of the Arrowverse.
Yes.
No. Cryer has had good roles.
Bad an actor and has had good roles.
And then you quickly revised it to good role.
Yes. And I said, unfortunately, it probably means more goofy Lex. Rosenbaum would have been a neat way to go. After further research, perhaps Cryer's only good role was Pretty in Pink.
My point is, this is atrocious. Like,
yes.
Even if you're going to do the comedic version of Lex, like I feel like there are numerous other actors or even a no-name that you could have gone out and gotten that would have been better than freaking John Cryer, because like even Gene Hackman, let's go to Gene Hackman. I think we would both agree, right? It's a generally comedic portrayal of the character.
Yes, sure.
But at least physically he like doesn't look like he could be snapped in two at any given moment. John Cryer is the least physically intimidating person on the face of this planet, I'm pretty sure. Like,
other than Jesse Eisenberg, maybe.
Like, it makes no sense to me. It makes no sense. I hate everything about this.
You're turning into he should turn himself in guy right now.
He should turn himself in for being a shitty actor.
Listen, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think you bring up a good point, but you just got to look at the results on the field. I don't call the plays, neither do you.
That's true.
In this case, the coach had a personnel decision he had to make, and he made it.
As I said in our group chat, if you were going to be forced to take a 2.5 Men alumni, I would have much rather had Charlie Sheen as Lex than this fucker.
Yeah, because at least Charlie Sheen can't act.
He would have done something crazy and different and like been, you know,
but
manic.
I don't know what the obsession is with goofy comedy unhinged Lex. I don't understand it.
That's not the direction they're going to go, or maybe they're going to try and subvert our expectations in some way, but
yeah,
it happens, on a surface level, I fucking despise this, and it really sucks because I have genuinely enjoyed most of this season of Supergirl up to this point, and I like where they're taking the characters, and I think it's setting up Lex's eventual appearance to be impactful, but my God, with this guy, I don't know. I don't get it.
I told Arn, I said, there's no way. I said, you can't fit that in Tommy Rich's rectum. And sure enough, Universe app, Young Justice Outsiders, the season 3 of Young Justice, will be debuting officially. We have January 4th, 2019. There was a teaser video released with it. This will be the third season, as mentioned, of the show. Can't wait for this, Nick. This is really exciting.
Yeah, this is, and it just means that I need to hurry up and, finish my attempted rewatch of Young Justice so that I'll be up on all the stuff, but I'm worried that it's not going to happen in time.
Yeah, I need to do that same thing because I'm a little foggy on some of the details of how it ended because it's been so long, but really excited about it coming back like that.
Absolutely.
And that brings us to our final item, which is the link doesn't work. Ah, here it is. Birds of Prey. We talked a lot about this movie recently, Nick. In fact, I'm sorry, I didn't even announce. We are standing right now, Nick and I, side by side, in the Worlds of DCEU corner.
Mm-hmm.
And we are talking about Birds of Prey, which we've been talking about a lot recently. Well, Margot Robbie has officially revealed the full title of Warner Brothers' planned Birds of Prey film, and it is Birds of Prey, open parentheses, and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, closed parentheses.
Indeed.
And there it is. It's a little bit of a parody of some of the longer Oscar-baity titles out there. And kind of funny, Nick, wouldn't you
say? Yeah, I dig the parenthetical use.
Yes.
Primarily, it seems to be parodying Birdman, that Michael Keaton flick from a few years ago. And I don't remember what exactly the parenthetical title of that was, but very long, pretentious parenthetical title. And so does this.
Yes.
So.
Which I've never seen that movie. Have you?
No, I caught like 10 minutes of it on TV one time, and I liked what I saw, but I just didn't have time to sit down and watch the entire thing. So.
It might make for an interesting off the page at some point, would it not?
Indeed, but it's not. Is it comic book based?
Well, it is about a superhero of sorts, fictitious nonetheless. But I don't know. We'd have to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to discuss off air.
Interesting if it were about the basketball player Chris Anderson, Chris Birdman Anderson.
See, I think it would be more interesting if it was about Harvey Birdman.
Or if it were about, fame rapper Birdman from the early 2000s,
what happened to that boy? Yeah, I know all about that. I know all about some Birdman. He wasn't good, but I know about him.
No, but he was a thing that happened.
He sure damn well existed, and probably still does.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
he's no Sheck West, that's for sure.
Don't know what those words mean.
See, I'm hip. I'm with it.
I know Lee West. He loves 1970s wrestling.
He does. He does.
Anyway, so that does it for the rundown. So let's move on to our weekly look at what we've been reading and watching. It's a segment, Nick, that we like to call Reading and Watching. So, Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
I have been reading something.
Oh, look at you.
For once, I have read, finally, after it's been in my possession for some time now, I have read Doomsday Clock.
Cock.
/ Cock. Number 7.
Mm-hmm.
I finished this by Jeff Johns and Gary Frank. Nick, have you read it yet?
No.
What was the last Doomsday Clock you cocked that you read?
I don't know.
Well, you need to catch up, sir, because this was amazing. This was spectacularly good comic book storytelling. I thought everything in this, I've enjoyed the whole series to this point. I thought issue 6 was a little bit of a slowdown, a little bit of a character building issue. This is just nonstop action the whole way through, stuff happening, important stuff happening, and I thought in particular the usage of Ozymandias in this issue was everything I wanted it to be and more. It was brilliant. It was, to me, it was a twist that I should have seen coming but didn't see coming. And just awesome. The whole execution of it, all the characters are kind of turned on their head here, put into different roles. It's awesome. Can't say enough about it. I don't want to say anything else to spoil it, but this was a fantastic comic book.
Indeed. I can't wait to catch up at some.
Yep, you're going to love it.
I'm sure I will.
So with that, let's move on to watching.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, I might kick off this segment by talking about The Walking Dead or Titans, but I have not actually watched them from this past week yet. I have not had time. So in lieu of having watched them, let's move on directly to the CW network and the shows that we were watching on there. Now, with full disclosure on that, I have not watched the most recent episode of Supergirl. So Nick has an advantage on me in that department. But since that's the last show chronologically for our purposes, we'll save that for last. So kicking things off last week was the latest episode of Arrow. And this wrapped up a 2-episode arc in which Oliver is undergoing treatment at level 2 in Slabside, the penitentiary. He only meets the long-rumored demon character that he's heard about from the inmates at Slabside that might have a connection to the outside world and to Ricardo Diaz. And to my surprise, Nick, it turns out to be Talia al Ghul, who we met, of course, a couple seasons ago, who worked with Diaz later on last season. She is alive, damaged, and inside of Slabside. And a really great nod to comic book fans that actually made me pump my fist a little bit when she said that Oliver asked her, how did you end up here after you were rescued by Diaz? And she says, foul of an old enemy in Gotham, which, holy shit, that was awesome. So
indeed it great, was. Indeed it was.
Great, great fan service there. Meanwhile, back in Star City to catch up with Felicity and Laurel as they are continuing to try and help out, or trying to catch Diaz, actually, but they become aware of this this evil doctor's plans in Slabside, and so they make it their mission to try to get to the bottom of what's going on there at level 2, why Oliver can't have visitors anymore, things of that nature. I continue to enjoy, and listen, anybody who's been a fan of our show a long time knows that it takes a lot for me to say I'm genuinely enjoying the Laurel character this season,
yes,
which I never thought I would say. And she's been awesome. Dinah's been good. We see a little bit of the rest of the team here, but they're the main characters in this episode. Again, it focuses heavily on Oliver and Felicity, lit from the other characters here and there, and setting up a hell of an ending for the Doctor and for Talia, and setting us up for the future with Diaz now having gained superpowers via this drug that he's been taking. And takes out the entire Bratva and has Anatoly in his vice grip, mm-hmm. dangling him off a building as the episode ends. I thought this was spectacularly good, Nick.
Yeah, Arrow is just firing all cylinders this year. As you mentioned, even getting to the point where characters that we typically wouldn't enjoy are even finding, you know, useful and interesting subplots this year. We've talked about Renee and Dinah for the last several episodes. You mentioned Laurel both last week and here in this episode as well. Really, the only character that they continue to struggle with is Curtis, but, you know, I will accept one character that they're not able mm-hmm. to find a real good use for when they're just handling every other subplot so well. Arrow continues to fire on all cylinders, as I said. Big thumbs up from me as well.
Totally agreed. So let's move on to Legends of Tomorrow. And this is an episode that's kind of a send-up of Wet Hot American Summer. It is a camp episode taking place in the 90s at a summer camp. As they find out that there is some sort of magical entity that is stealing kids from the summer camp in the 90s. And so Sarah, who else? Sarah, Ava, Constantine, mm-hmm. and Ray.
Ray. And then you have Zari and Mick back on the ship with their new prisoner, who I've already forgotten the name.
I think her name is Charlie.
There you go.
So anyway, they're on the ship, and anyway, the group that I mentioned, Sarah, Ava, Constantine, and Ray, infiltrate this summer camp to try and uncover what has been taking these kids. A lot of hijinks ensue. Ray is hilarious as always. At this point, probably the funniest character on the show to me. And he's great. Sarah and Ava get turned into kids at one point. Just a lot of crazy. There is an overt reference to Swamp Thing in the episode. First of all, with Swamp Thang, and then Constantine just casually saying that there is a real Swamp Thing, but he lives too far south to be sort of that's causing problems here. So Swamp Thing in the future will be cool, and just another fun episode here. The stuff on the ship was interesting. Seeing Mick be the one to actually bond with someone, which very rarely happens. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just another fun episode. A little step back to me, not as good as some of the prior episodes, but still pretty good.
Yeah, I would agree that it probably wasn't as good as the last couple, but this was another episode where, as I was watching it, I just marveled at how Legends of Tomorrow. I mean, like, I had this thought that Arrow, well, the show has gone through different eras, you know, mm-hmm. but if you go back and look at season one Arrow and compare it to today, undoubtedly, like I said, the show has changed and evolved, but it's essentially still the same show. Same with The Flash or Supergirl or what have you. Legends of Tomorrow now feels like it has become an entirely different show than what it was when it started. Mm-hmm. And that is in the best possible way. Like,
yep.
It has finally fully realized what it can be, what it needs to be, and continues to produce episodes like this week that, even if they aren't as good as other episodes, they are episodes that would only happen on Legends of Tomorrow.
Yep.
This show is a treasure and needs to be preserved at all costs.
Absolutely. I was going to say the same thing, Nick. We got to protect this show because the best compliment I can pay it is even a, quote, down episode of Legends, I have a smile on my face the whole time I'm watching it. Like, I'll at least be chuckling every few minutes. And it's so different. It is filling a void that does not – that can't be filled by any other comic book show. It's outstanding. I don't even know that it's like any comic book that's out there right now. It's just so different and fun and a great show, continues to be. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to Tuesday night and The Flash. This was a continuing a lot of the issues with Nora, Barry, and Iris as we finally get to the bottom a little bit of Nora's problems with Iris and actually get a little bit of resolution there. I was really glad to see that because, to be honest with you, Nick, I thought the Nora being resentful of Iris and Iris feeling bad about it was starting to maybe overstay its welcome a little bit. And so I was happy to see that get resolved here. And I thought it was a very heartwarming subplot in the episode, particularly in, when Barry kind of walks in on them bonding as mother and daughter for the first time. Very cool. Barry smiling and having fun and being a jokester and just the whole, everything involving the West this season has been great. And then for the first time, maybe this season, I freaking love the villain of this episode, Ragdoll, who's mm-hmm. a comic book character that that both of us know from Secret Six. And while he's different in this episode than he is in Secret Six, I much enjoyed all of that. The only part of this episode that I didn't think really landed with was the Caitlin stuff, because I'm not as invested as I should be in her search for her dad, even though I love Caitlin and love Cisco and all of them. But all that being said, this was probably my favorite episode of The Flash in quite some time.
Yeah, I love them. A little bit different version of Ragdoll than I think you and I are accustomed to from mm-hmm. from the pages of Secret Six. Like, not as I was kind of missing that that bizarre sense of humor that character had in the pages mm-hmm. of the comics. But still, this really worked in a way that a lot of the villain of the weeks have not worked to this point. And like you said, finally, seemingly moving past the Nora and Iris tension angle, I think will just continue to move the show forward. And no Chris Klein. So all things considered, pretty solid episode of The Flash.
Yes. And there was only one brief glimpse of the comedic, weird Ragdoll. And that was when he first appears in Bill Necklace mm-hmm. and he like models it in the mirror for a moment. That was kind of funny. But then he really lots of potential with that character moving forward. And they did a great job. Effects. Moving us on to Black Lightning, which I think, I could be wrong. There might be one more to go. I think might wrap up the Book of Consequences.
No, the first arc. Episode of the Book of Blood.
Yes. Okay. There we go. So, and this was a shocker of an episode, Nick, because I did not see. Now, obviously, I think you're probably on the same boat as me that I don't really think that this character is dead. Are you on the same boat, or do you think he actually is?
No, he's not. He's not dead. It's a comic book show. We didn't see a body, and even if we did, he's still. I mean, doesn't matter. He's still not dead.
Right. So, but they sure made it look like he was, and they did an episode exploring the grief of a certain character dying, and again, you know, like I said with the Flash, I think this was one of the better episodes of the season. This was largely on the strength of the acting from the youngest daughter, and especially the acting from Tress. I think his name is Tress Williams, right?
That plays
Black Lightning.
Cress
Williams. Yeah, his acting in this episode was out of this world. It was a realistic grief. It was not an instantaneous ball of emotion. It was just denying that this could even happen, suppressing his emotion for most of the episode, getting angry, and then finally just being overcome by it. I thought it was spectacular. There was other stuff that happened in the episode too with Khalil and with Tobias continuing to gain influence in the city again, and that was all fine and well, but this was really ultimately about an exploration of grief.
Yes.
And I thought it was excellent in that regard.
I would agree with everything you just said, especially as it relates to the performance of Cress Williams, showing the stages of grief. You know, you've got depression, you've got denial, depression, drunken acceptance, even like anger, just everything in it is
the whole bar.
It was awesome.
Wonderful.
Just fantastic. Yeah. I loved everything about this episode. Probably my favorite episode of Black Lightning so far this season.
Yeah, it was excellent. The only part that I continue to not like is the Anissa subplot, because I don't understand where they're going with any of it.
She is ultra wishy-washy. Like, if it's supposed to endear us to her as a character, I think it's having the opposite effect.
Yes, and I hate to say that, because I think she does a good job, the actress and everything,
right,
the character last year. But they're,
the narrative is muddled. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It feels like, does it not feel like there's a piece of the story that we haven't been told?
Yes, like what
happened to that singer that she was with, right. You know?
Why did she leave this show with a very ripped from the headlines approach to the main thrust of this first thing of the season? And I would say that this episode does more to advance the nuance of what they're trying to do than any episode previous. You kind of have James Olsen, who is beginning to realize that just telling these people that they are definitively wrong and denouncing them is not the way to go. Like, you can't, if you shout someone down, that is only going to make them hold their opinion that much stronger. And so you have James Olsen, who is trying to find a different way to appeal to them, set against the Lena Luthor and Kara approach of they're just wrong, just tell them they're wrong. And it really seems like it's move forward a new stage of the story where they're going to attempt to confront the complexities of how you fight something like hatred and how nuanced it can be. So I really like this episode. Not a whole lot in terms of action, I would say, until the very end, and I liked what they were going for in the closing action sequence that I don't want to spoil. But yeah, I thought this was one of the strongest episodes of the season to date.
Excellent news. Excellent news. So with that being said, Nick, why don't you start us off by ranking them?
Yeah, I'll go Arrow. I will go... Oh, man, this is the hardest one. God, this is probably the strongest week top to bottom yet, now that I think about it. I'll go Arrow. I'll go Flash, Legends, Supergirl, Black Lightning. But, I mean, any of these episodes, if you put them in any week, would finish, like, number two behind Arrow. You know what I mean? In any given week. I mean, to me anyway, strongest week of CW television of the season.
I might tend to agree. So I will go Arrow at number one. And I will go... This is a harder one. I will go Black Lightning at two. I will go Flash at three. And I will go Legends at four. Again, no knock on any of them. They were all fantastic this week. Well, that, I guess, about wraps that up, Nick, unless you've been playing something.
No, I've got no playing.
You know, one thing we have been playing, though.
What's that?
Fantasy football.
We have.
We haven't done this in a while.
Yeah,
we haven't updated people.
Listen, I have no issues talking about the current state of the fantasy football landscape, quite frankly.
Well, right now, the current state of the fantasy football landscape is that
you are looking up at my white Alabaster Keister.
Nick Duke is sitting atop the league in number one at 9-2. Mm-hmm. And in number two, surging from the bottom of the pack all the way to number two with a 5-game winning streak. Longest winning streak in the league, by the way, mm-hmm. is the Prestige Shah, mm-hmm. the team captained by me, Greg Phillips. Mm-hmm. So, Nick, I'm coming for you.
Mm. Well, come on.
And behind us is a bunch of other people.
I don't fear you. I have no fear.
Well, wouldn't it be poetic irony? I don't even know if that's a thing, but I'm going to say it anyway. Wouldn't it be poetic irony, Nick, if you were undone by the very quarterback who you traded away earlier this season?
Ah, but you have to remember, Greg, that move was not – it wasn't a move for the present. It was a move for the future. I am setting up the Hilton Hulkamaniacs to be a dominant force in the foosball league for years to come.
We have forces in the foosball league for years to come. Did you see who's number three now?
No.
Inexplicably, Matt Elifson's chief belief has crept up to number three after his 450 trades.
Well, you know, he's got it going. He's got it going now. He's using, let's see here, I'm looking at how many of those players used to be on my roster. One, two, just two. That's shocking to me, but there you are.
According to my notes here on the application, Matt Elifson has made 39 transactions this season.
Mm. You know, I've made a lot of transactions for me anyway this year. More transactions than I typically do. I think I'm at like 11 or 12. Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
and I'm at 26.
Right. So there you are. I'm sure people are thrilled by this. But yeah, I guess that about wraps it up for this week.
Oh, yeah.
But,
oh, look at the clock.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. That's right.
Yeah, there's roughly a minute on the clock.
Uh-huh.
You know, our clocks don't keep exact time here.
The wrestling 5 minutes last week.
Right. Well, this week we're going to get right back into it with the wrestling minute, mm-hmm. roughly. Nick, wrestling minute, what's going on?
Survivor Series and the NXT War Games. You know, as great as War Games were, I feel like Survivor Series is the more newsworthy thing. So we'll go. Man, that Charlotte and Ronda thing, huh?
Oh, that what a hell of a match. Really, the last two matches at Survivor Series, it says a lot about them because as great as War Games was as a show, TakeOver, it was an outstanding show. Better matches probably top to bottom. But all that I could think about on Monday was the last two matches of the Survivor Series, Ronda and Charlotte, and then Brock and Bryan, which I thought was a classic as well.
And what's great about this year is, you know, we're wrapping up November. We're getting ready for pay-per-view before the Royal Rumble really kicks off the road to WrestleMania. And I got to be honest with you, it feels like this year, more so than any other in recent memory, I have no idea what the WrestleMania card is going to look like.
Yes.
I couldn't tell you. I still think they're going to do Ronda and Becky at WrestleMania, but outside of that, I have no clue what the rest of that card looks like.
No, it's all so up in the air right now in that regard. Real quick, NXT note, Nick, have you finished watching the show yet?
No, I have to watch War Games still.
Gotcha.
The actual main event.
You ready for some Ciampa versus Black, I'm assuming?
I would assume that's the way they go, although I think there's also the possibility of a fatal four-way at the next takeover. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
That wouldn't surprise me either. Two excellent matches, by the way, between those four guys. Mm-hmm. So look, great wrestling weekend, Nick. And, you know, next year, Survivor Series is going to be in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So,
What's that mean?
I'm just saying that it's going to be in Chicago. It doesn't have to mean anything.
What means something. What's the for?
Well, maybe, depending on how things work out, a lot can change between now and then. A lot mm-hmm. can change. We'll just have to see.
Okay. Well, I guess we will. Well, I guess that that brings an end to the Wrestling Minute, and as a result, brings an end to our show this week. But as we have now, as something becomes something of a tradition here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys, we're going to be joined in a moment by a musical guest, Jim Ross. And this week, as you all know, is Thanksgiving. And I don't know about you guys, but there's nothing better than eating a big Thanksgiving meal and getting a belly full of delicious goat's meat and then coming in from that meal and deciding, you know, I feel absolutely miserable. I've eaten myself into a virtual coma. You know, what better time now to make sexual advances towards my partner? So here, sing you a song about making sexual advances towards your partner is none other than WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. Jim, take it away.
Well, once again, thank you for the mediocre introduction, quite frankly. Now, I'm here to sing to the audience again. I'm not making any money off of this. I'm not getting any sponsorships out of this. I would suggest to you that Casper Mattresses and Blue Chew are good.
This song is definitely brought to you by Blue Chew, huh, Jim?
Well, that's a good point. And speaking of Blue Chew, after I take a Blue Chew, this is what I start to sing. You know, when I start making love, I don't just make love. I be stroking. That's what I be doing, huh? I be stroking. Well, I stroke it to the east, and I stroke it to the west. I stroke to the woman that I love the best. I be stroking. Now, let me ask you something. Let me ask you something right now, quite frankly. You know, I asked Cowboy something one time, and he never answered me. And I asked him this. I said to him, what time of day do you like to make love? Well, he looked at me a little funny. I said, have you ever made love just before breakfast? And he said, one time with Hacksaw Butch Reed. And I said, you ever made love while you watched the Late Late Show with David Letterman? And he said, one time with Jim Duggan. And I said, oh, that's fair enough. And I said, well, let me ask you this question. Have you ever made love on a couch? And he said, well, hell yeah, I have. And I said, well, let me ask you this question then. Let me ask you this, you son of a bitch. Have you ever made love on the back seat of a car? And he said, you know I have, Jim. You were there. And I said, I remember one time I made love on the back seat of a car. There was a Casper mattress sprawled out in the back seat of a 1978 Plymouth. And the police came in and they shined his light on me. And I said, I'm stroking. That's what the hell I'm doing. I'm stroking. Anyway, I stroke it to the east. I stroke it to the Mid-South Coliseum. And I stroke it to the woman that I love best. I be stroking. Now, let me ask you something. How long has it been since you made love, huh? Did you make love yesterday? Did you make love last week? Oh, did you make love last year? Or maybe it might be that you're planning on making love tonight. But just remember, when you start making love, you make it hard, long, soft, short, and be stroking. That is the most important thing here that I would tell any talent in this business. I be stroking. I stroke to the east, stroke to the west, stroke to the woman that I love the best, and then I be stroking. Oh! I be stroking. Now, when I start making love to my woman, maybe Stacey Keibler, Tori Wilson, one of the great women that I signed in the Attitude Era, I don't stop until I know that she is sexified. And I can tell when she gets sexified, because when she gets sexified, she starts calling my name. She'd say, JR, 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 JR. Oh, shit, JR. The other night I was stroking my woman, and it got good to her. You know what she told me? She told me what she told me. She said, stroke it, JR, but don't stroke it so fast. If my stuff ain't tight enough, you can stick it up my... Woo! I'm stroking. I be stroking. I stroke it to the east, and I stroke it to the west. We heard all this shit before. Anyway, that is when Ric Flair walked in the ring, and he told me to stick it up his woo, and I said, get fucked, and then I got fired. They fired mine because I was stroking. Ha ha, yeah. I be stroking. Ha, yeah. I be stroking. I be stroking. Quite frankly, I be stroking.